nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Let's get started with a quick recap from the previous lecture, and feel free to ask me any questions if you have any. For the first part of today's lecture, I'm going to be using some of the slides you have from the handouts from the last class, so please refer to those. And for the second part, I have new handouts, so if any of you didn't get them, feel free to come over and pick one up. So this is what we talked about in the previous class. We classified integrated circuits along two dimensions, the scope of usage of integrated circuits, ranging from application-specific integrated circuits on the one hand, which are used in a very narrow set of systems, all the way to fully general-purpose products like microprocessors, which are used across a wide range of systems. And we also classified integrated circuits based on their degree of design customization, ranging from full custom design, where everything from the architecture down to the layout of each individual cell or transistor is done specifically and customized for that particular chip that you're designing. So that's full custom integrated circuits on the one hand, all the way to field programmable gate arrays, where the entire circuit has been prefabricated and you just program it after fabrication to implement the design that you wish to implement. So again, you have this entire spectrum ranging from fully customized to very little design effort. We also talked about the levels of design abstraction, which basically is a concept that came about to tackle the increasing complexity of integrated circuits, which we all know of as Moore's Law. And we saw that integrated circuits can be specified and designed at the system architecture level of abstraction, the behavioral level of abstraction, the register transfer level, the logic level, the transistor level, and then finally the layout. So the process of design can be viewed as refining the system that you wish to implement through these different levels of abstraction. Today we will quickly take a look again at the slide I showed towards the end of the last lecture, giving you an overview of how design is performed at the logic level of abstraction. So you have these different levels of abstraction, and there's different design tasks that need to be performed at each level. This course is about design automation, in other words, the use of software to automate the design process at the logic level of design abstraction. So we will look at the different steps involved in logic level design, and I'll give you a quick tour through the different problems or specific tasks that are involved in logic level design automation. And you can think of that as virtually a outline for the rest of the course. Okay. So a closer look at logic design. The designer starts off by specifying the circuit that he or she wishes to implement. As we saw in the last lecture, the specification consists not just of the design, which actually is a specification of the circuit that it should be implemented, but also the test bench, which can be used to verify whether the design is implementing the designer's intent correctly. So the first step that is performed, or the first task in logic level design, once you have a design and a test bench, is the process of design verification, right? And in this step, the intent of verification is to verify whether what you have specified is the same as what you have in mind, okay? And the verification process can either be based on simulation, which it very frequently is, where you use the test bench consisting of input vectors or input stimuli that specify various possible inputs to the design and check the outputs of the design and see whether it is conforming to the expected values or the expected waveforms. That is one way of performing verification. The other way of performing verification that we discussed was formal verification, where you formally build a model, a mathematical model of the design, and in that case, prove that it satisfies certain properties. So the test bench in that case may be replaced by properties which mathematically state that under certain input conditions, the output of the design should follow certain properties, right? So verification can be, you know, either based on simulation or based on formal verification. But in either case, the purpose of verification is to detect bugs in the specification itself. So once you detected all bugs and iterated through the process of getting your design correct, then the golden design is fed into the next step, the next major step in logic level design, which is synthesis. Synthesis typically refers to a process of refinement. So in this particular case, the design specification that you start off with is at what we call the register transfer level. We'll see in a little more detail what that means in this lecture and the next. But you start off with the design specified at the register transfer level, and you go through the process of synthesis, which essentially maps this design into gates and flip-flops, okay, so at the logic level. So this is typically done using a synthesis tool. And in order to guide the synthesis process, because for any given function, there is a pretty large space of possible implementations that you could use for the function. If you would like to implement an adder, for instance, all of you probably have come across different types of architectures for adders, ranging from the, you know, slow but area efficient and power efficient ripple carry adders, all the way to the very fast tree-based adders, which on the other hand are also larger and require more power consumption. So there is this inherent space of possible trade-offs between the different design metrics, such as area, performance, and power, that is inherent to VLSI implementation. And in order to guide the synthesis tool towards the direction that you as the designer wish to take, you specify various constraints and directives to the synthesis tool. Okay. Depending on your design style or the target implementation technology, whether it's an FPGA or a cell-based integrated circuit or a gate array-based integrated circuit, the synthesis tool will output a netlist that breaks your design down. It realizes it using building blocks that are either taken from the cell library in the case of cell-based design, or in the case of FPGA-based design, the building blocks are the lookup tables that you decompose your design into, right? So the netlist essentially is composed of structural building blocks that are used to put the design together. You know, these are gates, flip-flops. In the case of cell-based design, these are the gates and flip-flops present in your cell library that you give to the synthesis tool. It's not shown here on the slide, but implicitly one of the side inputs to the synthesis tool is the library that you wish to use to realize the design. And the synthesis tool outputs a netlist in terms of an interconnection of those building blocks. Once you have the netlist, you might wish to perform analysis where you take this netlist and you analyze it in terms of its area, its timing, its power consumption to see whether the implementation that the synthesis tool gave you really satisfies the constraints or directives you had or the objectives you had in mind. And again, you have various tools that can be used to automate this task of analysis that we will be talking about. Once you're satisfied with the design in terms of its properties, you go ahead and perform a final step of implementation verification, where, you know, in this case, you are checking whether what you had specified as an input to the synthesis tool, the design, is functionally identical to the implementation. Therefore, this is also called implementation verification, sometimes also referred to as equivalence checking, because you're checking the equivalence of two different representations of the same design. So again, you could use simulation for this purpose. You throw a bunch of vectors at both of these designs, both of these representations, and compare their outputs. Or you could try to use more powerful techniques to formally, mathematically prove that under all possible inputs or input sequences, these two are equivalent. Right? Both are approaches that are used in practice. So once you're done with the implementation verification step and you're satisfied that your implementation is correct, then you move forward to the next level of design abstraction, which is the physical design stage, where you basically perform place and route. You take these different cells that constitute the netlist or different elements and need to place them spatially on the chip surface. And then you need to use the different metal layers to actually interconnect them as per the interconnectivity patterns specified in the netlist. Okay? So this is basically a quick overview of the logic level design flow and the different steps. Of course, the specification step is very much manual. You need to perform it manually as a designer, but all of the other colored boxes shown here, the design verification, implementation verification, certainly synthesis and analysis can be automated and are automated often in practice. And we will be talking about the techniques used to automate these steps. Any questions here about this overall flow? Okay. If not, let's proceed. Now, each of these boxes, for instance, synthesis itself consists of a number of smaller steps, okay? So even though, you know, we've shown the entire design flow here and each of these looks like, you know, one specific aspect or specific problem, if you, you know, try to zoom into any of these boxes, you will realize that there's a number of sub-problems or sub-tasks that need to be performed. And let's look at that in the context of synthesis. So if you look at the problem of logic synthesis, which is synthesis at the logic level from the register transfer level to gates, it further consists of the following steps. You start off with a register transfer level specification, or RTL specification for short. And essentially it's so called because you specify the functionality in a functional manner, the hardware that you wish to implement, in terms of registers, variables, which are registers, and how the values in between of these registers are transferred, are operated upon by the combination logic and transferred between each other, right? Hence the name register transfer level. Typically you use hardware description languages like VHDL and Verilog. Those are common examples of HDLs in order to specify your design at this level of abstraction. The example shown here is Verilog. For those of you who are familiar with it, you will recognize the familiar syntax here, where you have a module defined with certain inputs and certain outputs. So these are the input and output ports of the hardware you wish to implement. And the functionality of the circuit you wish to implement is, in this case, encapsulated within an always block, what is known as an always block, which is guarded by the positive edge of the clock. So that essentially denotes that the logic that you're implementing is synchronous sequential logic. It is triggered by the positive edge. Whenever you have a rising edge of the clock, all of the variables that are updated within this block will get updated at the positive edge of the clock. And then you have certain operations that are used in order to look at the values of the different variables, the inputs, the registers, and then update them. Okay. So starting with this description, this is the input to a logic level synthesis tool. The first step that the synthesis tool is going to do is to parse this description, the register transfer level specification, right? The synthesis tool, remember, is a program. This is a file that it reads in. It parses it, and then it tries to map this into the familiar notion of hardware that we all have, which is, you know, hardware components connected by wires between them, right? So how do you do that? Well, in this case, based on the semantics of the language, whether it's Verilog or VHDL, the language semantics specify how each of those constructs in your RTL needs to be interpreted by the synthesis tool and mapped into hardware constructs. So the first step performed in the synthesis tool after parsing the register transfer level specification is called logic extraction, or also called elaboration. So in this step, essentially each of those constructs in the HDL is directly translated. It's a pretty straightforward one-to-one translation. Each of those constructs is directly translated into these hardware components. In this case, you can see that the hardware components include certain gates, which are represented as rectangles. In some cases, I've shown the shapes of the gates, multiplexers, and in this case, it has also inferred some flip-flops. So, for instance, just to give you one example, you can see that if you go back to the always block, we see that you have always at positive edge of the clock. The variables that are updated on the left-hand side of expressions inside this always block are G and H. Correspondingly, you can see that the synthesis tool, after elaboration, has therefore inferred flip-flops, edge-triggered flip-flops, triggered by the clock for G and H, right? And you will also see that depending on for each of those other statements in the register transfer level specification, the synthesis tool has inferred one or more of the constructs that you see here. Okay? So there is no optimization performed so far. This is a one-to-one translation of the functional programming language-like specification of hardware to the more traditional structural notion of hardware. Okay? Then, in order to actually optimize your circuit, to implement it in an efficient manner, right, the synthesis tool goes through a couple of different phases or steps of optimization. Okay? We'll be talking about these optimizations in more detail later in the semester, but I'll roughly categorize them into two different phases or two different steps. The first is technology-independent optimization. These are optimizations that make sense independent of the specific technology library or implementation technology that you would wish to use to implement the circuit. So for this process, for this phase, the structural register transfer level view of that you get from the RTL after elaboration or logic extraction is transformed into a data structure that is represented internally to the synthesis tool memory, which frequently looks like this. So this is essentially a network or a directed acyclic graph where you have the different nodes representing the different blocks of logic. So you can think of these as collections of a few gates. These are blocks of logic. Inside these, you can think of as having certain logic functions or Boolean expressions. corresponding to the logic that you wish to implement. And the arrows, of course, between the different nodes in this network represent the input-output relationships between those different blocks of logic functions. So you've taken the initial elaborated structural view, and perhaps by combining some of these different nodes in the elaborated view, come up with this network of Boolean gates, or super gates, if you want to think of them as super gates, because these expressions can be fairly complex, you know, not just your simple AND or, you know, NOT, NAND, XOR type expressions. They can be larger expressions. So this is a network of Boolean gates, super gates, which implements the function that you wish to implement. And at this level of, upon this representation, there's various optimizations that could be performed. You could take the Boolean expressions inside each of these nodes and simplify them, right, so that they are minimal. There is no redundancy in them. You could collapse some of these nodes. At the level of the graph, you could perform various transformations like collapsing multiple nodes into one to give you a larger scope for optimization. Or you could take a very complex node and split it into smaller nodes, and so on and so forth. You could take a structurally see that the initial, if you would like to optimize performance, for instance, you might see that the structure of the graph is not very conducive to high performance, and maybe you would like to try to flatten out this network and make it more balanced if it is very imbalanced in nature, right? So there's various optimizations that you can perform, which are independent, really independent of the specific technology library or the implementation technology. Yes, Pratik.
Do the nodes have a single output at this stage, or can they have multiple?
Okay, it's a good question. Do the nodes have a single output at this stage, or can they have multiple outputs? The nodes can have multiple outputs. Well, they can have both a single output that goes to multiple locations, which is called fan out, or they can have multiple outputs, which are really multiple functions. Both are possible. Any other questions? Okay. So technology-independent optimization is one of the important optimization phases in logic synthesis, and it is followed by technology mapping, where you take the optimized technology-independent representation, the Boolean network that represents your circuit, and then map it into, in the case of cell library-based implementations, you map it into cells, you instantiate cells from the target library, the technology library that you're going to be using to implement the circuit, and express your circuit, your particular Boolean network, your function, in terms of those gates. Okay, and here we can see that the blue rectangles represent instances of cells from the cell library. So this is a process of technology mapping that you need to go through, no matter whether you're targeting cell-based implementations or FPGAs. The nature of the cell library is going to differ. But eventually, technology mapping has to occur to take this generic Boolean network into something more concrete that you wish to realize. Okay, in the next several slides, I'm going to be giving you a quick tour through the different problems involved in logic-level design automation. And as I said, this is essentially a quick outline for the topics we'll be discussing in the rest of the course. Okay, we will start off with the classical problem of two-level combinational circuit synthesis. Well, this is of more than historical importance. Historically, this was perhaps the first design automation problem that was studied in any rigorous manner, in the context of logic-level design automation. But interestingly, if we look at the more state-of-the-art synthesis tools, deep down, embedded inside them, they actually use some of these techniques. So this is not just of academic interest. These techniques will be used, as we will see, when we go to the subsequent modules. Okay. So the problem specification here is the input is you're given a set of Boolean equations that specify the function that you wish to implement. And what you'd like to do is come up with a minimal two-level implementation. Now, what does a two-level implementation mean? Anybody would like to volunteer an answer? What do we mean by two-level implementation?
Having your front end of gates and then have your second kind of gates.
Right. So you have an array. The inputs to your function are processed by one level of gates, one set of gates, and then the output of those gates are fed to a second level of gates, right? And most frequently, or quite frequently, you hear of AND OR as the two levels of gates. The first level of gates are AND gates, and the second level of gates are OR gates. And these are, in fact, very often used to directly implement a circuit as what is called a programmable logic array. Okay. To give you an example, here are Boolean equations that specify two functions, f0 and f1, as a function of variables, input variables x0, x1, and x2. And of course, this is, you know, any combinational logic function can actually be expressed in sum of products form. So this is, you know, a universal representation. Any circuit can be represented either as AND or equivalently as NAND circuits, and translated into what is known as a programmable logic array, where you have the inputs and their complements fed into the plane of transistors called the AND plane. So this is basically an array of transistors that realizes the first level of AND gates, and then the outputs of these AND gates are called product terms, and they are fed into a second level of logic or second array of transistors called the OR plane, which eventually computes the outputs F0 and F1. Two-level implementations or programmable logic array implementations are still used for certain functions, particularly control logic, for example, in microprocessors. But they are not very efficient in general, because for certain functions or many functions, the two-level implementations tend to be very large, right? So in general, multi-level implementations are preferable for a large range of functions. In particular, all of the combinational functions that you encounter in data paths tend to have very large two-level implementations. So the next topic we will look at, therefore, will be multi-level combinational circuit synthesis, where we will generalize or relax this requirement that you should only have two levels of gates in your circuit. You can have any number of levels of gates in the circuit. So in other words, you can start off with a set of Boolean equations, or equivalently, you start off with an unoptimized Boolean network that is elaborated from HDL. A couple of slides back in the logic synthesis flow, we said that when you write a Verilog or a VHDL specification, the first thing that the synthesis tool does is elaborate it into an unoptimized network of these logic elements. Now, that could be the starting point for multi-level logic optimization or logic synthesis, and the output of this step is an optimized multi-level network of gates. Okay, so you start off with this unoptimized initial network that is directly derived from the register transfer level specification, and then perform the optimizations that you wish to perform on this, and end up with a network of optimized gates, which, you know, is either area efficient, fast, or power efficient, depending on your specified constraints and directives. The next step that we shall look at is technology mapping, where, as we just discussed, you start off with the technology independent implementation of the circuit and a given cell library to which the circuit should be mapped, and the output is really a mapping of the implementation to specific cells in the library. For instance, in this case, here on the left I have shown the optimized technology independent circuit from the previous slide, and on the right-hand side is the very same circuit with certain regions demarcated as gates from the cell library. So you can see this essentially is a NAND 2-1. This is a 3-input NAND, again a 2-input NAND, and this is an AND or invert 2-1. So this also shows, this example here also shows that the cells in the library need not necessarily be your basic gates, such as NAND or NOR. They could also be so-called complex gates, either AND or invert, multiplexers, full adders, things of that nature. So the process of performing this technology mapping in an optimized manner is a pretty interesting optimization problem, and we will be studying how it's performed in logic synthesis tools. Thus far, all of the topics I've talked about deal with combinational circuits. In other words, circuits that take an input and produce an output as a function of the current inputs applied to them. In practice, we know that a number of circuits are sequential, or most practical circuits that you use in real life also have memory elements in the form of latches or flip-flops, so they need to be sequential. So we will study the problem of sequential logic synthesis, and there's two different flavors of this. The first flavor of the problem we will look at is FSM synthesis, or finite state machine synthesis, where you start off with a finite state machine where your circuit to be synthesized is specified as a bunch of states with state transitions between them with appropriate conditions associated with the states and state transitions. And you will go through the process of FSM synthesis to eventually result in an optimized network of gates and flip-flops. Now, in order to do this, we will, of course, reuse the concepts that we already would have talked about in combinational logic synthesis, that is multi-level synthesis. Okay. So the idea is not to reinvent the wheel there, but to look at the additional steps that are involved before combinational logic synthesis can actually be proceed. Because if you think of a finite state machine specification, it is not really in a form that you can feed directly to combinational logic synthesis. There is a couple of key steps you need to perform. You need to perform state minimization, which is optimization of the finite state machine itself to either reduce the number of states, eliminate redundant states, or transform it to a form that is more amenable to an optimized implementation. And then there is the form, the problem of state encoding, which refers to the process of translating the labels that you have associated with the different states, you know, which may or may not be zeros and ones. You might just call your states with symbolic names, such as, you know, A, B, C, X, Y, Z, S0, S1, S2. You need to translate those into zeros and ones, because eventually gates don't understand, you know, arbitrary symbols. They understand zeros and ones. So that process of encoding symbols that are associated with the finite state machine into binary values is called state encoding. And both of these steps, that is state minimization and state encoding, profoundly impact the complexity of the circuit that will eventually result after you go through combinational logic synthesis. So we'll be talking about FSM synthesis, in particular state minimization and state encoding. Now, this is only one of the flavors that is used of, or one of the two approaches that is used for sequential logic optimization, right? Why is that so? Because not all circuits are amenable to compact or easy representation at, as finite state machines. If you think of a data path with 32, just a single 32-bit register, right? How many states are would be present in the finite state machine representation of that data path? 2^32, right? And that's about 4 billion. Now, 32 is not a very large number of bits or flip-flops, right? You know, modern microprocessors have thousands, at the very least, maybe tens of thousands to maybe a few hundred thousand flip-flops in their data path. Now, can you even think of constructing a finite state machine with 2^10,000 or 2^100,000? Out of question with computers we have today, right? So the finite state machine representation is not amenable for, it's not suitable for all classes of sequential circuits. Therefore, there's another class of optimization techniques we will look at, which start off with a structural representation of a sequential circuit, which means a network of gates and flip-flops, and optimize it without really trying to convert this into a finite state machine. Okay, so if you start off with a structural representation of a circuit, and one example of an optimization technique, a very powerful, simple but powerful optimization technique that you can use to optimize this from a sequential logic perspective is known as retiming, right? What you do in retiming is basically move the flip-flops around in the circuit, move the positions of the flip-flops relative to the gates. And what is interesting is that in doing so, if you follow certain rules when doing that, the functionality of the circuit is not changed. So if you look at the example here, you have two flip-flops, you have three blocks of logic, and you have these two flip-flops as the outputs. If you move these two flip-flops to the inputs of these two blocks of logic, turning them into four flip-flops as shown here on the right, the two circuits are functionally equivalent. Okay. However, from a performance or area or power consumption point of view, there can be a number of differences between these two circuits, right? In particular, as many of you may be aware, the clock frequency, the period at which, the frequency at which you can clock a circuit is determined by the longest path through the combinational logic. And what you've done in going from the circuit on the left to the circuit on the right is by moving these flip-flops, you have broken what was the longest path in the combination, through the combinational logic into two shorter paths. And therefore, the circuit on the right most likely can be clocked faster. This is a higher performance circuit. Okay. On the other hand, of course, since you have more flip-flops, this circuit is also going to consume more area and possibly more power consumption. But retiming gives you a powerful tool with which you can trade off, you know, speed, area, and power consumption. And this certainly goes beyond the scope of combinational logic synthesis. You can, you know, do this orthogonal to optimizing these blocks of logic, the combinational logic, okay? You can do retiming. It goes over and beyond combinational logic synthesis, and it does not require building a finite state machine representation of the circuit. So you can do it on data paths. You can do it directly on structural representations of circuits, which have large states, spaces, which cannot be represented as FSMs. Okay? So that's, yes?
This kind of retiming is being done by the tool or by us?
All of the techniques that I've talked about, in fact, all of the slides I've been talking about, last five or six slides, are all steps in logic level design automation. So in this course, well, they can be done manually or by tools. We will be talking about how they can be done automatically by tools. Okay, so thus far we primarily focused on synthesis, which you will recall is one of the three major facets of design automation. Synthesis, verification, and analysis. Those are the three major facets. So we've dealt with a number of problems that arise within synthesis at the logic level. We will also be talking a little bit about verification. One of the specific problems we'll talk about is equivalence checking, where, as we discussed, the input, so in this case, you're verifying that the specification, the register transfer level specification, is equivalent to the implementation. So the input is two different representations of the same circuit. One of them is the pre-synthesis and the other is the post-synthesis, typically. But these could be, you know, even circuits, going back to Jolene's question, these could be circuits that are manually designed as well. So you as a designer may have tweaked a few gates in your in the implementation. This may not have been automatically synthesized, yet you could still use a verification tool to verify the circuit before you may perform your manual optimizations to the one that results from after you perform it. So basically you need two different versions of the circuit. Commonly this could be the specification and the optimized implementation, and the output of the verification process, the equivalence checking process, is either a proof, an assertion that these two circuits are functionally equivalent, or a counterexample that shows you that they are not equivalent. Right? So the verification tool takes two different representations of the same design, of the same thing, and either tells you that they're equivalent or it gives you a counterexample. In this case, the counterexample, if it's a combinational circuit, would be an input vector, which if you apply to both the circuits, will cause at least one of the outputs to take different values in the two different circuits. Right? The other form of verification, this is design verification, where you are verifying whether your specification is consistent with your intent that you, design intent that you have in your mind. It's called property checking, where the input is the specification. This could either be the specification or the final implementation, but you also give properties that must hold. For example, these could take the form of assertions that you put at various places in the code, in your RTL code. And again, the tool is going to analyze the design together with the properties and either give you a proof that the property holds, tell you that I've formally verified that this property always holds, or it's going to give you a counterexample demonstrating that it does not hold. And here we look at this, illustrate this with a sequential circuit example. You know, this is a finite state machine of a traffic light controller. Most of you have probably come across this in your undergraduate digital design class. You know, you have a finite state machine consisting of the states of two different signals at an intersection, right? So each of them could either be, you know, green, yellow, or red. And a property that you may wish to verify is that both of the lights are never green at the same time. Of course, makes sense to verify that. And you typically encode this property using a formal property specification language. In this case, you're saying that this property is always good, that not G1 and G2. In other words, G1 and G2 are never true at the same time. And this property goes into a verification tool along with either the specification or the optimized implementation, one or the other, and then the tool gives you either a result saying that this property holds, or it gives you an input sequence in this case that forces the finite state machine to go into a state where this property is violated. Okay. So we've covered synthesis and verification. The final facet of design automation that is left is analysis. So we will be also talking about analysis. One of the specific problems in analysis at the gate level is timing analysis, where you're given as input a gate level implementation of a circuit. So again, you know, it's a sequential circuit, you have flip-flops and you have combinational logic, and the timing analysis tool is asked the question, what is the frequency, what is the highest frequency at which I can clock the circuit and it still have it working correctly? Of course, in order to answer that question, the tool needs to have a certain model of the delays of the different gates in the circuit, not just standalone, but when you connect them to each other, when, you know, they have in their context in the circuit. So those models are used by the tool, but eventually it gives you an answer that says the clock period, the shortest clock period, or equivalently the largest frequency that this circuit, highest frequency circuit can operate at, is 500 megahertz, or equivalently the clock period has to be at least 2 nanoseconds. The simple approach to doing this, as we just talked about, is to look at the longest path through the combinational logic and say that, hey, you know, as long as I clock my circuit slower than the longest path through the combinational logic, I know that the combinational logic has enough time to compute its outputs before the flip-flops latch in the new values. So therefore, I know this should be correct. You know, give or take a little bit of period, you know, essentially a setup period that it takes for, you know, flip-flops to actually register the values. So, but basically the clock period of the circuit is determined by the longest structural combinational path through the circuit. Now, that is a valid approach, but in practice, often it can be conservative, unnecessarily conservative, meaning that if you use the value that topological timing analysis, the structural longest path tells you, you may be clocking your circuit slower than you could potentially, right? So, but if your competitor is clocking their circuit maybe at 600 megahertz and you're selling your circuit at 500 megahertz and all the other specs are the same, guess whose chip the customer is going to buy? So you have an incentive to really, you know, given a circuit, to clock it at the truly fastest clock frequency it can take. And in order to do that, a better and more accurate approach to timing analysis is essentially to eliminate what are known as false paths from consideration. Because false paths are, briefly speaking, paths that cannot, under any combination of inputs, ever propagate a logical signal to the outputs. And false paths do occur. In fact, they are extremely commonplace in real circuits. So if your timing analysis can be made aware of false paths, it can give you a more accurate answer and a more aggressive answer, which hopefully can, you know, help you clock your circuit faster. For example, to illustrate the issue of false paths, if I ask you the question, what is the maximum delay of the following circuit? It's a pretty simple circuit. Assume that the NAND, two-input NAND gate has 2 units of delay, right? We'll just express timing in terms of some abstract unit. It could be nanoseconds, picoseconds, doesn't matter. 2 units of delay in the NAND gate. 1 unit of delay in the multiplexers and inverters. So how fast can you clock the circuit? What is the clock period for the circuit? The simple answer you probably would give me is, if you look at the longest path through the circuit, it's shown using the dotted red line, which is, you know, 2 units of delay through the NAND gate here, plus 1 unit here, which is 3, plus 2 units in the second NAND gate, which is 5, and finally 1 unit of delay in the multiplexer. So the longest path is 6 time units, and that is the clock period. You need to clock this circuit at 6 time units. However, if you really think about it, can this path of length 6 time units ever propagate a value from the input to the output? Why not? The select signals of the two multiplexers are complementary. So at any given point in time, once all the values in the circuit stabilize, you know, if this select input to the multiplexer here is a 0, the other one has got to be a 1, or vice versa. If this is a 1, this is going to be a 0. However, in order for the value from A to propagate to the output, you require both of the multiplexer select inputs to be 0. And we know that that can never happen. So if you really understand the functionality of the circuit and try to take that, the implications of the correlations between the different gates, the way they are connected with each other, and the functionality of the gates, if you take all of that information and try to give a more accurate answer, you will actually realize that not only the path from A to the output, but also the path from B to the output, both of these are false paths. Both these paths are of length 6, they are false paths. Therefore, you can actually clock the circuit faster than 6 units and still have it work correctly. Okay? So that is, in a nutshell, the problem of false paths, and which is what makes timing analysis interesting and challenging. We will, time permitting, we will also hopefully talk about power analysis, where the input again is a gate level implementation of the circuit, and the output is an estimate of the power consumption, right? How much power does this circuit consume? Now, there's different flavors of power analysis. You know, when you say power consumption, you may be referring to the average power consumption across all possible input sequences, or you may be referring to the worst case power consumption. You know, what is the maximum possible power consumption across all any possible input? Or you may be, you know, referring to inputs with certain statistical characteristics which represent your workload that you will be using the circuit for. There are these different flavors of power analysis, but the common problem that is solved is given some information about the circuit and some information about the nature of the inputs that the circuit will see, because power is a function of the signal statistics, the probabilities of the different internal signals in the circuit, assuming the value 0 and 1, and the probabilities that they will have transitions, right? So you need information not just about the circuit, but also about the input statistics. But given that information, compute an estimate such that, you know, this, for example, like this circuit is going to consume 150 milliwatts at, of course, a certain frequency and a certain supply voltage. Okay. So we will also briefly touch upon this problem of power analysis. So hopefully that gives you a flavor of the different topics we'll be talking about in the rest of this course. That by no means is all there is to talk about in logic level design automation. So I have to certainly pick the most relevant topics and some representative subset of topics, but there is other interesting topics to talk about as well, which more likely than not we will not get a chance to discuss here in this class. There's the problem of manufacturing test, which basically refers to the step of testing all the circuits that you fabricate to ensure that they are free of any defects, right? As we know, the manufacturing process is not a perfect process, right? You'd be lucky if 90 or 95% of the chips that you actually fabricate out of your fab come out to be defect-free or working correctly. So certainly you cannot ship 5 to 10% defective chips to customers, right? That would, you know, ruin your reputation as a company and you'd be out of business in no time. So you need to, a very important challenge that all semiconductor manufacturers face is how do you filter out all of those defective chips or bad chips? And in order to filter out these defective chips, of course, you know, the intuitive approach you use is you apply a certain set of tests or test vectors to these chips and observe the responses, right? And you have upfront a set of expected responses that the chips should give if they are defect-free. And you compare the responses to the expected responses, and if any of them differ, you throw the chip away saying that this is defective. That is the overall approach that is used, but it's much easier said than done. Because you would ideally like to get a very high confidence that if a chip passes the set of manufacturing tests that you apply, it is indeed truly defect-free, right? The defect levels that manufacturers target for chips going out to customers are in the order of few parts per million. Anything more than that is not acceptable, right? So on the other hand, manufacturing test itself is a pretty expensive process. The way it works is you have these expensive, huge machines, which are sort of, you know, like the machines used to fabricate the chips, except these have these probes that go and apply the various inputs to the chips and then collect the responses and compare them with the golden or expected responses. These testers are extremely costly. So you would like to minimize the amount of time that each chip spends on the tester, or equivalently maximize the throughput of number of chips you can process per second on these testers. But that means that the number of tests you can apply to each chip is very limited. You cannot apply the exhaustive set of inputs or input sequences, right? And think of a microprocessor, right? What is the set of exhaustive inputs? All possible sequences of instructions. Of what length, you know? So it is inconceivable in many cases to think of exhaustive testing. So you need to come up with a very compact, small test set that still covers all the defects or catches, you know, typically 99 plus percent of all the defects. Right. So that's a very challenging problem. Yes, Pratik.
Would simulation-based test be more time-consuming, or would this test be time-consuming? This you are doing in real-time, so it should be, you should be able to test more.
Sure. You are doing this in real-time. So Pratik's question is, compared to the problem of design verification. So I think embedded in your question is a nice observation that this seems similar to the problem of design verification, right? In other words, you know, I have an RTL specification. I'd like to simulate it with different inputs and check if the results are what I expect. At a very high level, yes, right? But the difference being that, you know, in the case of simulation, you're right. You're simulating the circuit, the chip on a computer, and therefore you don't use this expensive tester, but it's also much slower in that case. On the other hand, the actual process of manufacturing test, it is, you know, depending on the specific technology or technique that you use for manufacturing test, you know, it is going to be either at the intended operational speed of the chip. So if you're fabricating a processor that's going to operate at 1 gigahertz, you know, the test at the best case would operate at 1 gigahertz. But more often than not, it's going to operate at a fraction of that, you know, maybe 1/10 of that or a much lower frequency, right? But still, it's going to be much faster than your ability to simulate the circuit. So yes, you can perhaps apply more tests, but that is still a very small fraction of the set of all possible inputs. And moreover, arguably, you need to be much more exhaustive, because in design verification, you know, the nature, the class of possible errors that could occur is perhaps a little more limited. You might, you know, if you're simulating your RTL, you may have, you know, missed a line or used the wrong variable. You know, typically, on the other hand, the defects that occur after manufacturing can be much more subtle, right? Everything may be correct in the chip. One of the gates has a transistor that is completely shorted or stuck on or stuck off. You know, you need to use a very specific combination of vectors. And the other big problem is that in simulation, you can observe any variable. Whereas in actual chip testing, you can only observe the pins of the chip. Okay. And, you know, that is very, very limited. The degree of controllability and observability that you have in actual manufacturing test is far lower than what you have in simulation. Okay. So, you know, there are certain things which are more efficient and less efficient in each case, but the bottom line is manufacturing test is a considerable challenge. The design automation aspect of manufacturing test is, you know, there's a couple of specific problems I've listed here. One is the problem of automatic test pattern generation. In other words, you know, generate a set of compact tests that I can apply to the set of possible chips, to all the fabricated chips, each of the fabricated chips, that will detect most of the defects that could occur. And this test set should be as compact as possible, right? In order to do that, you need to abstract the space of defects using what is known as a fault model. Again, we'll talk about, you know, at a couple of different points in the class, I'll refer to these problems and give you suggestions of how some of the techniques we talk about can be used to address them, but these are not, you know, they're outside the scope of the course itself. The other problem in manufacturing test is design for testability. The problem of manufacturing test, especially because of limited controllability and observability that I referred to, is extremely, extremely challenging. So more often than not, these chips include additional hardware that is used to actually make the circuit easier to test. A very common design for test technique is known as scan. What that does is it takes all of the flip-flops in your chip and threads them into this long shift register. So in the test mode or scan mode, you can actually directly inject values into all of the flip-flops, as opposed to applying a complicated sequence of inputs to control the internal flip-flops to certain values. You can directly scan in values into the flip-flop chain, run the circuit for one or a few cycles, and then scan the outputs of the values in the flip-flop chain again out. Okay? So that requires additional circuitry called design for test, but that makes the test problem easier. Okay? So again, that process can be automated as well. In addition to that, to manufacturing test, there's various recent developments. So this is as technology evolves, as circuits scale, on the one hand, making the complexity of the problems that these tools solve higher and higher, but also as fabrication technology scales, introducing all sorts of new issues that these tools need to consider, there are various new developments that take place in the area of logic level design automation. One of them, for instance, is analysis and reduction of noise, also referred to as signal integrity, right? As the dimensions of chips shrink, wires are getting closer and closer to each other, whether they're running side by side on the same layer or on top of each other, right? And therefore, the capacitive and inductive coupling between these wires grows stronger and stronger. And that can lead to, in the worst case, errors in the operation of the chip, or at, you know, the very least, it can lead to increased timing and increased power consumption. So you need to, your design automation tools need to consider that, right? Another important emerging area of research is the area of coupling logic synthesis and physical design, also known as physical synthesis or physically aware synthesis. So we will, in this course, be talking about the problem of logic synthesis without any information about how these different gates are going to be placed and how the wires are going to be routed. Okay? But we will need to assume something about the parasitics, the parasitics of the different wires in order to estimate the timing and power consumption of the circuits. Right? So, but that's a chicken and egg problem. How do you know the capacitance of the wire without knowing how long the wire is? To solve that problem, classically the approach that is used in logic synthesis is what is known as wire load models. So you make a pessimistic assumption based on the projected area of the circuit. So given the number of gates, you have rough rules of thumb that say that this is going to be the size of this circuit after I place and route it. And you say that this is going to be the average length of my wire. Now, the problem is that that worked quite fine as long as the wire delays were a relative small fraction of the overall clock period compared to the gate delays. Now, in deep submicron technologies, wires have not been scaling as the same way as transistors. As a result, wiring impacts the overall timing and power consumption of these chips in a much more profound manner, and it's a much more first-order effect. So this approximation technique of using a wire load model, either it gets too conservative or it's too optimistic, it basically doesn't work. It's not accurate, right? So coupling physical synthesis, the placement and routing with logic synthesis and doing them in a more integrated manner is one of the recent emerging trends that you see. Another trend that people are trying to pursue is bridging the gap between semi-custom and custom design. We talked about custom design where you take your circuit and optimize it all the way down to transistors. As opposed to that, you have semi-custom design, in particular cell library-based design, where you have a pre-designed set of leaf components or cells, and you decompose your circuit in terms of those cells. Now, if you, the gap between custom design and semi, and cell-based design is actually quite large. It may be 3 to 4x in terms of performance or power consumption. So people have been trying to look at, try to bridge this gap to some extent while retaining the ease of automation and benefits of cell-based design. And last but not the least, you know, those of you who've done any devices course or maybe even the 559 MOS VLSI design know that manufacturing variations is a major issue as devices go to the nanometer scale. No two transistors on a chip are going to be the same, even though they're designed to be alike. And the same transistor instance on different chips is going to behave differently. So considering these variations, for example, when you're analyzing the timing of a circuit, is becoming more and more important. So, you know, just want to conclude, you know, saying that, you know, this is very much a vibrant area of technology development and research. You know, we will be trying in this course to lay some of we'll focus on the fundamental principles and foundations, right? And many of the techniques we'll talk about, of course, can also be used to solve these other directions, but we are not going to be covering all of these recent developments necessarily in this class. Yes, Asan.
I have a very generic question regarding manufacturing. Does that suppose that you start with a circuit that works perfectly fine? My question is more directed towards the reliability issues. So suppose a certain chip breaks after 5 operations. How do you test those out?
That's an excellent question. In fact, there has been increasing concern towards what is known as early life failures or infant mortality. Now, if you look at the failure rate of chips versus time, you know, any product versus time, any electronic product versus time, you know, it follows what is known as the bathtub curve. You know, and you'll see why I call it that. It looks like a bathtub, right? So this x-axis here is time. And the y-axis is failure rate. So if you take a set of, let's say, 1 million chips that you fabricated, typically, you know, during manufacturing or shortly thereafter in the early life, a number of chips would tend to fail. Okay? And hopefully your intent as a manufacturer should be to simulate these early life failure conditions during manufacturing test so that you get, when you're shipping to the customer, you want to get to this point. You don't see all those early life failures. How do you do that? Well, there's a number of ways to do that. One of the techniques that is used to do this is essentially called burn-in, where you operate the chip at extreme conditions, either elevated temperature or, you know, increased frequency beyond its intended target, or, you know, increased supply voltage, for instance, right? To essentially accelerate, try to compress this process, because you do not, I mean, this could essentially span through a few days, and you do not want to be putting each chip for a few days on the tester, right? So typically the way you simulate the early life failures or accelerate early life failures is through burn-in. Try to compress this process, and hopefully by the time you shipped chips to customers, you have this steady failure rate, which is hopefully low. And then once, you know, a chip reaches, you know, there's various degradation mechanisms inherent to semiconductors, and, you know, once a chip reaches a certain point in time, it starts degrading and you see this accelerated stage of failures. But typically, you're not concerned about that. I mean, these are of concern only in extremely high reliability systems, maybe servers that need to be operated up, you know, 24/7. But what's been happening as, you know, as devices scale is, you know, multiple effects, right? So you have the burn-in, the early life failures extending more and more into the life cycle of the chips, right? So that is one trend that happens. The other trend is that this steady rate of failure has also been increasing. And then, you know, due to various other degradation mechanisms that have come in, the end-of-life failures also have started kind of coming in. So this entire bathtub has sort of is starting to collapse. So that's an interesting, you know, area of, you know, there's a lot of challenges there with, for instance, studying, performing, how do you really perform burn-in at a very low cost? Because, you know, you can perform burn-in if you dedicate enough cost to it or put each chip under, on the tester for a sufficient time, right? The question is you also want to contain your manufacturing test costs, yet get to the point where you reach this plateau in terms of defect rate, right? That's an excellent question. Okay. So that brings us to the conclusion of, you know, this particular module, the introduction module of the class. Hopefully that gave you a good flavor of the different topics we'll be talking about in during the rest of the semester. What I'd like to do for the remaining 15 minutes or so that we have today is to get started with the next module. Yes, Zoha.
There's a homework on page 35. Are you going to...
Thank you for reminding me. Absolutely. Thanks for reminding me. I think I was going to announce it at the end of the class, but you know, might as well do it now because this is a good transition point as well. We'll change the date. We'll work with you. No, this is still 5 days from today. So we can actually change the date to the 26th and make it Thursday, since I intended to announce this during the last lecture but never got to the slide. So, okay. I typically do this for all the classes that I teach. It really helps me to get to know the students and also to get an early pulse of the different backgrounds and essentially make sure that from a background perspective and the prerequisites perspective, all of you are reasonably well positioned. So what I'd like you to do is if you could upload onto Blackboard by next Thursday a one-page description of yourself, a technical description, focus on your background, focus on your interests, what made you take this course, why are you interested in this class, what you would like to learn from it. And the last part certainly is also quite important with respect to the project. As I announced in the first lecture, it's a programming project. So you will be implementing a program of moderate programming complexity without much support from me or a TA. And therefore, I would really like to see from each of you a brief description of one or two of the most complex, from your perspective, the complex software programming projects that you have undertaken in the past. Okay. So if you could please do this, in order to incentivize it, give you some reward for your effort, I'm going to be allocating 1% of the overall grade to this homework. So if, in case you haven't decided to take the course yet, if you're just checking it out, please do this as soon as you decide that you're taking the class. Okay. So yes, that's homework one. And I've changed your hard copies say that the deadline is Tuesday the 24th, but I've just changed it to Thursday the 26th. Okay. So you have a week from today to do this. Hopefully all of you have been able to test out Blackboard and have gotten it working. So should be relatively straightforward. Okay. So for the rest of this lecture, I'd like to get started with the second module. So the second module is going to be on advanced Boolean algebra. This should carry us through the next couple of lectures as well. Here's a quick outline for this topic. We'll do a quick review of Boolean algebra as you hopefully learned it during your undergraduate digital design class. And certainly the intent here is to go well beyond that. Okay. Why are we studying Boolean algebra? Because it forms the theoretical underpinning of most of the techniques that are used in logic level design automation tools. Right. So Boolean algebra is the mathematical basis for how you represent logic functions or logic circuits and how you manipulate them, okay? So Boolean algebra is, you know, concepts we learn in this module will essentially form a foundation, conceptual foundation for the rest of the course, okay? So within advanced Boolean algebra, we will talk about a more formal definition of Boolean functions and how they are represented, because certainly if circuits are Boolean functions, design automation tools are programs that need to represent these Boolean functions as data structures. So we will talk about different techniques that you can use to efficiently represent Boolean functions and manipulate them in various ways to perform different operations on these Boolean function representations. Okay, and in particular, one noteworthy operation that we will talk about, which is incredibly important and has a large number of applications is the operation of cofactoring. Okay? The notion of cofactoring a function with respect to a variable or with respect to another function will be used to explain a principle called Shannon's expansion and another important concept called quantification. And then finally, we will conclude this module with a description of a simple paradigm that can be used to tackle complexity. So we talked about one of the major challenges in design automation being the fact that circuits scale all the time, right? As these circuits get more complex, the tools that process these circuits need to be able to cope with larger and larger inputs, right? One of the simplest yet most efficient ways of handling complexity is divide and conquer. And in this context, in the context of Boolean functions, we will look at unit recursive paradigm, which is one particular way of performing a divide and conquer approach to various operations. It's fairly generic. You can use the unit recursive paradigm to implement a range of operations, manipulation steps on these Boolean functions. So the reading for lectures 3 to 5, hopefully you've had a chance to brush through your basic Boolean algebra that you've learned in your digital design course. If not, as I mentioned, feel free to look at Dave Meyer's lectures. You know, he has a nice set of audio with the slides that he has for module 2 in particular on Boolean algebra. You know, it's about an hour to hour and a half. Should be, of your time should be plenty to review the material that is relevant to this course. And the techniques that I will be talking about in this module are described in the DiMichele book in chapter 2.5, or in case you would like to look at the Hactel and Somenzi book, they are basically in chapter 3, specifically 3.1 to 3.3. Okay. What is Boolean algebra, also known as Boolean logic? It's essentially a family of operations on a set of two symbols or two values. Now, the two symbols can be 0, 1, true, false, you know, A, B, X, Y, doesn't matter what you call them. You have two symbols, you have a set of operations on these symbols, and a certain set of laws or axioms that these operations need to satisfy. Put all of these things together, and you have a Boolean algebra, right? That's basically what it is. Now, the basic operations that we refer to in the context of a Boolean algebra are conjunction, also known as the logic AND, and we will, for this module, we'll denote it as the conjunction symbol shown there, X and Y, which looks like a little inverted V. The disjunction or logic OR, which looks like a V, shown there on the right, X or Y. And the negation, which we also know as complementation or logic NOT. And it's a unit, it's an operator that operates on a single variable, unlike AND and OR, which take two inputs. And here it's denoted as NOT of X. Using these three simple operations, you can construct complex operations, which is essentially any formula that you can compose by combining these simple operators. Some of these complex operations have names because they're used commonly in practice. For example, exclusive OR is X, X, or Y, and hopefully we all know how to expand exclusive OR in terms of the basic operations that I've listed above. A slightly more interesting example is implication. X implies Y. Right? In other words, if X is 1, then Y has got to be 1. Right? That's essentially what this means. That's how you interpret this. It's denoted with this little arrow going from X to Y that says, if X is 1, Y has got to be 1. Now, how do we represent X implies Y in terms of the basic operations? Would anybody like to volunteer a guess?
1 times X, twice is equal
to 1 times
X.
Y equals 1 and X. Well, as we will see in the next slide, 1 and anything is the same thing itself. So 1 and X is X itself, right? So this is the same as Y equals X. But we've said X implies Y means if X equals 1, Y equals 1. If X equals, and that is consistent with Y equals X, certainly. But if X equals 0, what does it say about Y?
The latch. Something like a latch.
This is a combinational function, so there is no latch, right? Y can be anything. either 0 or 1. Right? So it's not quite the same as y equals x. Any other guesses? How about let's try... not x or y. Let's look at this, right? If x equals 1, not x evaluates to 0, and 0 or y, how can that evaluate to 1? Only if y is 1. So y is forced to be 1 in order for this entire function to evaluate to 1. Right? On the other hand, if x is 0, not x is 1, and this whole thing evaluates to 1, because 1 or anything is 1, independent of what y is. Right? So, another way of saying f equals x implies y is saying f equals not x or y. Right? So, this is only one example. If you think about it a little more, I'm sure you can get to the same expression, but there's a whole bunch of complex expressions you can build using these basic operations. Some of them have names like XOR, XNOR, implication, and so on. Yes, Jitin.
Why gets the value, or is it some function f?
No, this is, so just like when you say x, x, or y, you know, you're not saying y is related to x. Some other function equals x, x, or y, right? Z equals x, x, or y, or f equals x, x, or y. And these are functions of two variables, x and y. Similarly, x implies y is also a function of x and y. Okay, so you have these basic operations and complex operations that you can build by combining the basic ones. And you also have these laws or axioms that we will be looking at in a moment that these operations need to satisfy, right, in order to be called a Boolean algebra. And there's an interesting analogy to the algebra of real numbers, which, you know, you all looked at in high school or earlier. Essentially, you know, in the algebra of real numbers, you have the operations addition, multiplication, negation, and the constants 0 and 1. And there's a direct analogy between these and the Boolean world, where you have the set of the Boolean space, set of values 0 or 1, or any two symbols. And those particular symbols, you know, the 0 and 1, are again the special constants. We'll see in a minute what role they have. And then you have the disjunction or corresponding to addition, conjunction or and, which is analogous to multiplication, and complement, which is analogous to negation. Okay? So we will explore this analogy a little more in the next slide. But before we go there, let me also present a different interpretation of Boolean operators. You can also think of Boolean operators as representing set operations. So you can think of Boolean variables as essentially representing set membership. For example, X, you know, is the set of all students who are wearing black jeans today, right? And Y, let's say, is a set of all students who are wearing sweatshirts. So X and Y is a set of all students that are wearing both black jeans and sweatshirts. So in other words, it is set intersection. Similarly, the Boolean OR can be interpreted in terms of, so the Venn diagram representation that indicates the set interpretation of these Boolean operators is given for each of the Boolean operators. So X or Y is nothing but set union, right? So the and the OR are the easy cases. X or Y is nothing but those parts of X that are not in Y, as well as those parts of Y that are not in X, right? So essentially, it's basically X union Y minus the intersection. X implies Y, if you really think about it, and use the expansion I've shown here, will evaluate to this, okay? The shaded part here. So Boolean operations are, you know, useful also to represent sets and operations on those sets. Now let's get to the laws of Boolean algebra. Here are the laws that any Boolean algebra must satisfy, right? So, you know, given a set of two symbols, a bunch of operators that you call your and, or, and not, all of these laws need to be satisfied. We'll start off with the basic commutativity law. I assume most of you, if not all, are quite familiar with these. If you look at Dave Meyer's lecture notes, he talks about these as well. So we start off with commutativity, which basically says that when you're taking two variables and taking their conjunction or disjunction, the order does not matter. X or Y is the same as Y or X. X and Y is also the same as Y and X. Associativity refers to the fact that, you know, the property that if you have a series of conjunctions or disjunctions, the order in which you do them does not matter. So, as you can see, if you take X or Y or Z and you do the Y or Z first, or you do the X or Y and then take the result and OR that with Z, in both cases you get the same answer. And similarly with AND. So associativity is a property that holds for both conjunction and disjunction operators. You have the property of distributivity as well. And so in the Boolean world, AND distributes over OR and vice versa, as well as OR distributes over AND. So the first distributivity law says that X and Y or Z is the same as X and Y or X and Z. And the distribution of disjunction over conjunction also holds. In other words, X or Y and Z is X or Y and X or Z. Then you have the identity laws, which say that 0 and 1 are the identity values with respect to conjunction and disjunction respectively. So X or 0, anything or 0 is the same thing. Any entity and 1 is the same thing. Okay. And then you also have the annihilation property, which says that anything ANDed with 0 is 0. 0 kills anything. Anything ORed with 1, so 1 kills anything when input to the OR operator, is 1. Okay. You have the idempotence law, which says that you take X or X, anything OR itself is the same thing, and anything AND itself, again, is the same thing. You also have the laws of absorption, which say that if you have X and X or Y, the result is just X. You can ignore the second term. Similarly, if you have X or X and Y, the result is again X. And sometimes these laws, it helps to, if you use the set notation and you essentially draw the Venn diagram interpretation of what these laws mean, it becomes pretty apparent and obvious. Finally, you have the last two laws, the one of complementation, which says that X and its complement is 0. Similarly, X or its complement is 1. And you have the double negation law, which says that the complement of anything is the same thing itself, is what you started off with. So a double complement is the same as doing nothing. And finally, you have those familiar De Morgan's laws, right? Hopefully, have you all come across De Morgan's laws in your digital design course? Okay, good. So essentially, it says that you can change an AND to an OR by complementing the variables. So essentially, not X and not Y can be written as not of X or Y. This is also, you can also see this structurally, and this is how you probably have learned De Morgan's law in your undergraduate digital design class, is that if you have a gate, a NAND gate, right, you can convert this into an OR gate by moving these bubbles to the inputs. So move the bubbles to the inputs, convert an AND to an OR, and it's exactly the same. Both of these are equivalent to each other, right? And that's essentially what the De Morgan's laws state, okay? So there's this interesting duality principle, which essentially says that a Boolean algebra is unchanged if you switch 0 and 1, if you suddenly call 0, 1, and 1, 0, you just switch the two, and you similarly also switch disjunction and conjunction, logic and logic OR, all of these laws still hold the same. And I'll leave that to you as a homework exercise to go ahead and figure it out whether, you know, you switch 0 and 1, switch and OR in all of these laws, they should all still make sense. They all still hold. Okay? And that's referred to as the duality principle. Okay. I guess we're out of time, or in fact, past time, so I'm going to stop here with one final question, right? Some of you may have noticed that I've shaded some of these laws in a different color. Well, it's supposed to be red. It looks sort of, you know, brownish red from here, but some of them are black and others are red. What is the significance of this shading? What is special about the laws shaded in red? Any guesses? A hint is, go back to the remark I made about the analogy with the set of real numbers, right? What is special about these laws that I have shaded in red?
They don't look like those real numbers, like x plus 1 is not 1.
Exactly. These laws do not hold in the world of real numbers, which is why, you know, the analogy between Boolean and the Boolean world and real world is not complete. It's not, you know, 100% analogy. The laws in black have an analogy, have a direct correspondence in the world of real numbers. The laws that I've shown here in red are special to the Boolean world. That's what makes the Boolean algebra unique and different from the algebra of real numbers. Okay, I'll leave you on that with that note, and we'll pick up in the next lecture from where we left off. Thank you.